Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. I'm coming to you from the Baseball America podcast nook. Aaron's on the East Coast this week. Aaron, every week it's a different spot for you and me on this podcast now.
Yeah, it seems like it. It's we've just been crisscrossing this country, haven't we?
We're traveling fools, and maybe just fools, but we're traveling fools, that's for sure. I want to remind everybody that we have our new BaseballAmerica.com, if you haven't already noticed it. Completely redesigned, relaunched. The BaseballAmerica.com/college link still works. All of our college stuff is there. What used to be called the college blog is on there. What used to be the on-campus stuff, it's all on there. Just BaseballAmerica/college. And I think if you play with the tags at the new BaseballAmerica.com, you will enjoy the fact that there's a lot of college archives. If you just do the slash BaseballAmerica.com/t/college, anything that's been tagged on campus. The slash T, the tags, is very important with the new BaseballAmerica.com. And Aaron, it's made your life a little bit easier, it feels like, just editing and updating the website, right?
Yeah, it's going to be a good thing, I think, for all of us. And looking forward to seeing some of the possibilities with this new site.
Well, I think we all are. I think it's going to be exciting going forward for us. And let's go backwards real quick and talk a little bit about college baseball this weekend. Aaron, one of the things that you did this last week was you were in a couple SEC locales. Then you went up to Indiana, and first of all, you got to see college baseball in March in the snow, being the challenge that it is, and what those schools have to deal with from a logistical standpoint. And yet you saw two top 25 teams in Indiana and Louisville. And let's talk about the Cardinal first of all, because a pretty eventful week for Louisville, where they lose a series last weekend to Rutgers. We moved them down the rankings. They lose a midweek game to Indiana. And then, Aaron, you get to see how good Indiana was. You also got to see Louisville coach Dan McDonnell really lay into his ball club, and they really responded this weekend with a sweep of another top 25 team in Notre Dame to get back on track in conference play. Talk a little bit about what you saw in Louisville, and then what they did better to bounce back from that and sweep the Irish.
You know, one of the things that struck me, and I could hear some of what Coach McDonald was telling to his team in that post-game huddle, because the music was cut off and, you know, his voice was carrying. And he was saying, look, you know, where's your swagger? You know, that's one of the things that it felt like had been missing, I guess, for that previous week. And they looked very flat against Indiana. And you know, I kind of had a feeling that they were gonna bounce back from that, and that they were gonna play with a little chip on their shoulder this weekend against Notre Dame, and I think that's what happened. I mean, they played up to their capability. You know, that's certainly a quality Notre Dame club. That's a really good sweep for Louisville. And look, that team is they're very good. I mean, Louisville. You know, they got so much speed. I think it's a real asset for them that they can really disrupt you. And you know, I saw it even in that game against Indiana. You know, Adam Engel gets on base, and he just makes things happen. He steals second base, he'll steal third base. You know, they'll get him in on a sack fly. I mean, he'll just drive pitchers crazy. And I saw him kind of create box because people are just worried about him over there. And you know, Cole Sturgeon does that, and they've just got speed up and down the lineup, and they've got a lot of depth. You know, and they didn't play well, like I said, the day I saw them, but I still saw, you know, why they're good. I mean, they've got a lot of pitching depth. I mean, you know, the arms that they threw out there were quality arms. And they just had a little bit of a lull, and now they're out of it. So not surprised Louisville bounced back, had a very good weekend, and not surprised that Indiana keeps rolling, because Indiana is legit, John. I mean, those guys are – that's a really good college lineup.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about Indiana in a minute, but I had a good Twitter question that I thought I'd throw out. That I thought that Louisville was the right place to throw this question out. It's our friends at VU Hawk Talk. It's a Vanderbilt fan who blogs and tweets about the Commodores. Asked, can we discuss the top closers so far in the NCAA this season? And he throws in Brian Miller of the Commodores as one of those suggestions. I think there's a lot of good closers out there in college baseball here, and a lot of teams that are built bullpen forward. But I don't think there's anybody who – I think – am I correct in saying that it's Nick Birdie and then everybody else, when you consider the fact that this guy has 41 outs that he's recorded, and 32 of them have been via strikeout.
That's pretty insane, isn't it? I mean,
he's insane.
He's got really good numbers to go along with. He certainly has got the most electric fastball out there. I mean, it's crazy. He hasn't given up a run yet. He's only pitched 14 that you look at. In those 14 innings, he's got 32 strikeouts. I mean, it's utter domination right there, you know. But I think you could make a case for Brian Miller. You know, I mean, he's partly because he's worked 28 innings. I mean, he's only given up one earned run. He's got an 0.33 ERA, and he's worked more than twice as many innings. So you know, there's value in that. I mean, that's a guy with a resilient arm who can go multiple innings. And he's a lower slot guy with some firmness and life on that fastball. It'll be 88 to 90, 91 maybe, and kind of a sweeping slider that like a frisbee slider that really eats up left-handed hitters. And he's good. He's really good. He's had a great year. You could certainly make a case for him being the most effective closer out there right now.
That's a pretty good list. That's a pretty good place to start. And, you talk about low slot guys. I mean, Dave Berg certainly kind of fills that same role. I know he doesn't have as many saves, but the innings pitched are very similar. To me, Berg and Miller, it's kind of hard to separate those two guys. They've had very similar seasons as far as closers go. But Louisville, I mean, you have to get a lead to get to your closer. And those two teams, Vanderbilt moving back up to number two this week with Oregon State's loss to San Diego. But Indiana is a team, Aaron, you mentioned them. I want to get to them. Indiana is a team that just seems like it has no problem getting leads. It's a very good offensive team, and you saw them in person. You saw the ballpark. Just give us a little bit of – and then, of course, Indiana went out and beat Louisville, and they sweep Iowa. 22-3. What's their winning streak? 15 games right now?
15 straight, yeah.
Talk a little bit about, though, I mean, we've talked a little bit about Indiana, but what makes them tick and what makes them so good offensively this year?
Well, they're just loaded, you know, and yes, it starts with Kyle Schwarber and Sam Travis, those kind of physical power-hitting sophomores, but, you know, I mean, you got Scott Donnelly in there, and you've got Dustin DeMuth, who's both those guys are older players with some more physicality, and DeMuth can really run as well. Michael Basil, the shortstop, senior guy, you know, I mean, all these guys have been around. They've got veterans all over the place in this lineup. You know, it's an older team, and they've got more pitching depth in the past. If you want to compare them to that team a few years ago that had, you know, the three first-round picks with Fegley, Bayshore, and Arnett, this team has more depth than that team had, you know, it, especially on the mound. That's where it really stands out. They've got various pieces to help them get to the back of the bullpen. You know, Scott Efros has been really good. I saw him against Louisville and you know, just a lot of life on the fastball, and he commanded it. And Ryan Halstead back there at the back of the bullpen is a nice veteran closer. And they've got a solid rotation, too. I mean, it's three guys that they trust. So I just think they're a really complete team. I think they're in really good shape, you know, on track to host a regional. I feel like between Notre Dame, Indiana, Louisville, and Kentucky, you've got four regional host caliber teams in those two states, and obviously they're not all going to host.
That is really crazy to think about from a geography standpoint there.
Yeah, and I would think that Notre Dame is probably now fourth in that pecking order after getting swept by Louisville. I could see Louisville and Kentucky both hosting, and Indiana, though. I mean, it seems nuts to have three in that same kind of geographic region within 3 hours of each other, but, you know, why not? I mean, Texas, the state of Texas is down. You might be looking at only one in Texas with Rice. You know, there's the state of Florida is down. I mean, besides Florida State, who's going to host in that state? Maybe there's more regionals go around elsewhere.
That's kind of crazy to think about. Really is kind of crazy to think about. And I want to throw out real quick for Tracy Smith here, maybe try to put him in a little bit of perspective as far as coaches go, because this is not a guy that we usually talk about among the great coaches in the country and in that region of the country, you know, deservedly so. I think you start with Scott Strickland because of taking Kent State to Omaha, and Doug Schreiber, the job he did at Purdue, finally getting over that hump last year, getting them in the regionals for the first time since 1907, hosting a regional. A lot of great, you know, Big Ten, MAC coaches. Here's a guy who's been in both those leagues, but guy had close to a .600 winning percentage in his time at Miami. And Indiana, I think there was a lot of work to do at Indiana. I mean, no disrespect to Bob Morgan, who preceded him there and won 1,000 games, basically won 1,000 games against a not a good schedule. And I don't know that Indiana, I don't know when the last time they won the Big Ten was before Tracy Smith got there, but built it up to that 2009 team, his fourth season there, where they stumbled out of the gates but finished strong, won the Big Ten, went to regionals, had a first-round pick and a supplemental first-rounder. You know, they built the ballpark there. Feels like Tracy Smith, you know, you look at what he did at Miami, there are a decent amount of Miami of Ohio Jokers in the big leagues that he coached, the John Elis and guys like a Chad Reinicke or Justin Knadler, guys who made it to the big leagues that he coached there. And now it feels like Indiana that he's produced producing some prospects there and winning games. Just feels like a guy who's a classic coaching grinder who's really starting to see the fruits of all that labor with this year's team.
And I'll tell you what, if you would have known that it would take them this long to get this new ballpark going, I wonder if he would have gone to Indiana in the first place, because their old park was not adequate. You know, I went over there, you know, like Ben Greenspan, one of their assistants, was kind enough to, you know, spend some time with me on Tuesday night, one of those off days while I was waiting out the snow. And, you know, he kind of took me around campus, and one of the places we stopped was the old ballpark, Sembauer. And my God, John, I mean, it's, you know, you've got an incline behind the infield. You know, it's like a giant dip.
Are you kidding? The old park?
I mean, it's bad. The old park. I mean, the playing surface was atrocious. Obviously, it's not, you know, they're not maintaining it right now because they're not playing on it. But I mean, it's just so incredibly uneven. I mean, the whole park. I mean, it was not good. I mean, it's amazing that they had the kind of success that they had at that park. You know, this thing was a long time coming. They thought they were going to get a lot earlier. They had broken ground originally several years before, and then the project got kind of shelved. And you know, now they finally did it again, and now they got it going. I mean, those guys do a great job recruiting nationally. We know, of course, that they've had success getting players out of San Diego, you know, from Alex Dickerson and now Joey Donato, and they've had others along the way. They get players, obviously, out of their own state, and you know, and they develop talent. And
I mean, Halstead right now, their closer is a Rancho Cucamonga guy, right?
Another one. There you go. I mean, they do. They're not afraid to go out there, and they say that it's surprising when you get kids from the West Coast to Bloomington and they experience this kind of real college town kind of atmosphere and the enthusiasm of the fans out there. It's not as hard of a sell as you'd think. But I like the way that they approach that. I mean, they say they like to. They don't recruit a player who doesn't have at least one major league caliber tool. That's their approach. I mean, they believe in tools. Tracy has a scouting background, and you know he kind of takes that approach with his recruiting, and it works for them. I mean, all their guys can do stuff. You know, that makes them. I think it makes them a very exciting team to watch.
Well, yeah. I mean, you saw them up close and personal. So I mean, yeah, it was only one game, obviously, but it's they yep. gave you a good look, which is always better than not giving you a good look, you know. So, as Dan McDonnell can attest, he preferred for his team to have given you a good look, and when they didn't, that was unfortunate for them. It's the Baseball America College Podcast with John and Aaron. Aaron, another Twitter question. We've got a good response on Twitter today, so people, you know, you guys can keep it up for next week. He's at Aaron Sitt. I'm at John Manuel BA. Can always email us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. But Ryan Combs asked a broad question, seeing as how, Aaron, you've seen so many different teams all over the country really this year in different conferences, you know, from the coast to Houston to now you're going to come up here today and see North Carolina and Clemson and all over the Midwest now. Broad question, what do you think about the quality of umpiring? He was specifically talking about the Virginia-Miami series this weekend that he thought was NG. You know, yesterday I'm thinking about this with the Louisville's on my mind. I watched the end of the Baylor Louisville women's basketball game. I can't believe I'm saying that, but I did.
Wow.
I did watch that. I watched the end of Brittany Griner's college basketball career. But that was an incredibly, and I just think in general college basketball is incredibly physical and poorly officiated. And I think the experts in that field have said that. I'm not making that up on my own. I'm reading Jay Billis and all these kind of things. I don't know that I feel like college baseball officiating or umpiring affects the game as much as it does at the basketball level. But in general, you know, Aaron, over the course of your career and mine, it feels like college baseball, I don't feel like college baseball umpiring has gotten worse or better over the last few years.
Right.
It just feels like it's always, you know, modest to bad.
Yeah.
It's rare that it stands out for how good it is. But in general, it's they're amateur players and it's amateur level umpiring, and I don't feel like it's any worse or any better in 2013 than it was in 1997. Do you feel it's any worse or any better than it was from 2005, the first year you were covering college baseball for us?
No, I don't think so. I mean, when umpires are doing a good job, nobody's going to notice. And in fact, when they're doing a good job, half the time they're still going to get yelled at by the fans, because anytime they make a call, it goes against your team. You got to heckle them. I mean,
that's
I hate
it.
That mentality, but that's how it is. And that's the most thankless job in the world. Because even when you're doing it right, you're doing it wrong in the eyes of half the people in the stadium, or more than half, you know? I mean, so I think umpires get an unfair rap. You know, and I get tired of the constant heckling at ballpark. I get tired of it. Just let it go. For God's sake, watch the game. If it's a really egregious call, I can see getting upset. But every time a ball's called outside and you're saying, come on, Blue, you know, wake up. Give me a break. Enough of that garbage. Just watch the game.
I'm so with you. I love it. I love how you said it. When you really think about it, it just gets – that is the way that some people watch a baseball game. They can't watch a baseball game without complaining about the umpires. And I've never been that guy. I wasn't that guy before I became a sports writer. I saw a great tweet about this the other day from Jeff Bradley, formerly of ESPN and the Mag, now working for MLS. And Jeff played at North Carolina with Walt Weiss's roommate. And became a sports writer. His brother is Scott Bradley, who's the head coach at Princeton and was a big leaguer. So Jeff knows what he's talking about. You know, his other brother is the coach of Egypt's national soccer team. So he really knows what he's talking about when it comes to officiating and what coaches think of it and what managers think of it. And he talked about how a sports writing mentor told him that you become a sports writer when you forget how hard the game is. And he always thought that was ridiculous. He always thought that was wrong. It was actually something that he took the opposite of what his mentor intended. And I think I do think that people just don't realize how hard it is to be an umpire. And if you think about how hard it is to be an umpire and how hard it is to play the game at that level, you view it differently as a spectator. And you scream less and you ride players less and you ride umpires less. And that would just be my advice, whether it's a parent or a fan, is just to remember how much easier it is to be a fan than it is to officiate or play. And if you try to keep that in mind, I think that makes you a better fan and a better spectator. That's my opinion, but that's what you're here for on the Baseball America podcast. And I'm with you, Aaron. I just think I think officiating isn't good, but, I mean, it's also really, really hard. And you pay your money. You certainly have the right to act a fool and take out your frustration on officials, and I have the right to think you're a fool for doing it, and I have a right to think less of you for doing it. And that's how I am about it. So
I just think that you know, the best fans are the ones who are really loud and vocal in a supportive way of their own team. And yes, you know, I understand there's going to be blown calls, and it's fine to get on the umpires when that happens. But if you're doing it the entire game, then you're just a heckler who cried wolf. You know, it loses all meaning. I think that there's very few games that are actually determined by the umpiring. I mean, thinking back, there's been a handful of games where I thought, wow, this team really got jobbed, and you know, it cost them their season. I mean, there's been a handful of games, you know, in 9 years or whatever for me, 8 years doing this, that's been the case. It's not many.
Aaron, we got a little sidetracked, but I think it's a worthwhile discussion. Got a couple other Twitter questions, so we're going to – it's a shorter podcast today. Let's just take a few Twitter questions here, Aaron, and hit on those. A question from Colin Parker. Can the Big South be a multi-bid league, Aaron? We don't have any Big South teams in our rankings right now, and this is perennially, with rare exceptions, a one-bid league. There have been a couple times, maybe 10, 12 years ago, where maybe you had a Coastal and a Winthrop that both got in. But right now, you know, Coastal has been the dominant team in this league for a long time. And yet the Chanticleers are struggling, just 15-12 overall. The team that's really running away with things from a overall record standpoint is Campbell. But the Camels, only 6-3 in the league. They just lost a series at home to Radford this weekend. Collins' question, can the Big South be a multi-bid league? Just eyeballing it, I would say no. What's your take there?
No, I don't think so. No way. I mean, even Campbell, they're 23-5, and they just haven't played a good schedule. I mean, I like Campbell. I like the way they play. I like their speed, their up-tempo approach, but they just haven't played a good schedule. I mean, that's it. You can't take that seriously right now. Presbyterian, I guess, has the best RPI in this league, but that's not going to hold up, I don't think. Right now it's 38, according to Warren Nolan. And I just, I think that's going to drop, and it's going to be a one-bid league. That's just the bottom line.
It really would be stunning for Presbyterian to get an at-large bid. And it's also very strange to see how that – I mean, obviously they played Florida State a couple times, and that's where the boost is coming in their RPI, because they've played North Carolina Central, Savannah State, and New Jersey Tech. So I don't quite see how their RPI is that high, but hoochie mama. Yeah, I don't see it either, but definitely appreciate the question from Colin. And then Mike Green, who is at Jays Fan Toronto, asks, he's read varying reports on Chris Anderson's stuff. How would we grade each of his pitches and command? First off, Mike, we're not at scouts, but we could talk. We've talked to scouts about that. And I just talked to a scout the other day, Aaron, at the NHSI, when I asked him about guys who've moved up nationally in the draft. It's all stuff that we've talked about. Jonathan Gray for Oklahoma. The season Mark Capella's had, kind of cementing himself at the front of this. Personal cheese ball, Hunter Renfroe, while his team is struggling at Mississippi State, really Hunter Renfroe is probably really one of the few hitters who you can really say has really helped his draft stock. But Chris Anderson, he mentioned, as one of the guys who's improved his draft stock. You've written about him this year. You've talked to scouts and coaches about him. What are you hearing about Chris Anderson, the right-hander in Jacksonville?
Well, he's got serious buzz for sure. I mean, he's moved himself into that kind of first-round category, really. I mean, it's a big-bodied guy that has figured out how to pitch, and he'll show you that premium velocity, that mid-90s fastball, and the secondary stuff has come a long way. I mean, he's really made progress, and he was on the map last year in the Cape. He showed decent stuff, but I mean, his stuff is taking a jump. I mean, it'll be 90-96. He's got the makings of a pretty good breaking ball. He's developed a pretty good changeup. That's been kind of one of the keys for him, is that he didn't really have that as much in the past. He locates a curveball and a slider, but the slider is really more of the out pitch for him. That's the swing and miss pitch. So he's a four-pitch guy with great body. I mean, I think he sure looks like a first-round pick. But then again, he got knocked around this weekend. So, I didn't get a report on him after this weekend. But the reports that we've gotten on his stuff have been pretty positive.
Right. I will say Mercer is a good program. Yep. Very solid program, just a good athletic program, and they hit. That team hits. He gave up either three or four home runs. It looks like it's he gave up three of the home runs. Mercer hit four in the game. He gave up three home runs. He also had 10 strikeouts and no walks. So it sounds like he had good
weird
stuff.
Weird line.
pardon me?
It's a weird line.
It's a very weird line. He gave up a lot of hits, like 11 hits in six innings, 9 runs. Three home runs, and then he had no walks and 10 strikeouts. So I think he's pretty good. And Mike also asked, should GMs consider the weaker conference he plays in when evaluating him? Obviously you do, but that weaker conference also produced Chris Sale. That weaker conference,
yep.
It to me isn't that weak of a conference here. And I mean, I think the Atlantic Sun's pretty solid over the years that the membership has changed. I think people know, I think scouts know what they're getting out of that league. I mean, Rex Brothers was out of that league and he got to the big leagues pretty quick. Stetson has had big leaguers out of that conference. Kennesaw has had high draft picks out of that conference. And I just talked about Chris Sale. I don't think of the Atlantic Sun as weak. I think of it as a middle of the road conference.
And you know what else is they played a good non-conference schedule. I mean, he beat TCU, he beat Central Florida, he beat East Carolina. And I know you're down on, we're all down on Conference USA a little bit, but there's still, I mean, he got the better of Ben Lively and Jeff Hoffman. I mean, those are pretty good pitchers to beat. You know, and he's they've challenged themselves with their schedule, and he's been the bright spot for them. They lost all those three of those series, but they won the game that he pitched.
Yeah, I mean, that's good stuff. Good questions on the podcast today. Again, we encourage people to hit us up on those, but this week probably the one that we've been most active in answering questions here, and just the way things worked out. A couple of quick things as we wrap up the podcast here that I did want to hit on. Virginia. Let's talk about the Cavaliers. This is a team that was not ranked in the preseason top 25, a team that we talked about last year in the preseason top 25 and left them out and kind of see how they build up. And it was really a bridge year, to use the new sports term, for Virginia. They were good enough to go to regionals, but really not a team that was ever really a threat to go to Omaha or really even host a regional. That kind of that ship sailed by about this time last year. Right now, Virginia is 25-3, and while they did have a weaker stretch of non-conference, they won that series at East Carolina to start the year, which, of course, looked better at the time, but they've won all three of their ACC series, including a sweep of NC State, won a series at Clemson. Three of the four have been at home, but pretty hard to get more impressive than Virginia has been at 25-3.
And let's not forget, John, they did host a regional last year.
Sorry.
I mean, you're right. I mean, it felt like a bridge year coming into the season. It felt
like they
hosted
a regional,
and they still hosted a regional. That's exactly right. I think it kind of demonstrates that program. I mean,
yeah, really.
When you think they're going to be down, they're not down.
Ignorance.
Well, no, I mean, whatever. It's just it's a mental lapse. But I mean, it's just amazing to me the consistency of this program. I mean, they're just they've done it again this year. You know, they just. They're really good. They're a good team. We've talked about how good their offense is, you know, how explosive they can be, you know, with all those sophomores especially, and then the seniors, you know, the veteran guys like Reed Gragnani in there, and you know, and Jared King, and you know, it's just a nice blend of experienced guys with younger players that are very talented, and really impressed with Scott Silverstein. You know, this is a guy that has come all the way back from multiple shoulder surgeries. He's had a long, hard road, and he's 5-0 now, and he's pitching better and better for them as they go along. I mean, he's gotten a lot better. You got to give him a lot of credit. He has not quit, and he's become a very viable weekend starter for them.
Yeah, I mean, he's left-handed size. I mean, it's really a complete team. I mean, is there a weakness you think other teams could exploit as the year goes on, as ACC teams, attack this team and the year goes. I mean, their schedule's fairly favorable. I mean, you really look at it as far as they do still have four league road series to go at Georgia Tech, at Virginia Tech, at North Carolina, and then this weekend, upcoming at Wake Forest, which has, you know, been scrappy, kind of like where Wake Forest is right now, scrappy but not a great team. You know, what's your take? I mean, How many series down the stretch is Virginia going to be favored in? It feels like they're going to be favored in most of those series.
Yeah, I would say at Wake Forest, home against Duke. You know, the others, I mean, they've got three tough road series, I think. I think at Georgia Tech, I think I would still probably favor Georgia Tech in that series. I think at Virginia Tech is not an easy series.
And the Hokies just took two out of three from Florida State this weekend?
Yeah. Hokies are tough at home, and they got a really good ball club. I still like their team a lot. And then at North Carolina to finish up. So it's not an easy schedule. But, you know, they've handled their business so far. I mean, at Clemson, home against NC State and Miami, you know, and then, of course, home against Maryland to start. Those are four, you know, quality teams. I mean, even Maryland, I think, is a decent club this year. And you know, they've taken care of business there. I mean, you got to give Virginia a lot of credit. Do they have weaknesses? Yeah. I mean, I still think now some of the freshmen on the pitching staff they're leaning on, you know, you never know how freshmen are going to hold up in the second half of the season. We see that all the time with freshmen wearing down. It's one of my concerns with Cal State Fullerton is how will the freshmen hold up. But we're already seeing Brandon Waddell hit a little bit of a rough patch here. He wasn't as good on Friday. You know, only lasted three innings, and you know, he hasn't been as good lately as he was earlier in the season.
Aaron, we're going to wrap up the podcast here. We can go in a couple directions. We have Oregon State losing its first series of the year, dropping from 2-6. They lose 2 out of 3 at San Diego. We could go the Florida Atlantic direction. FAU new to our top 25 for this first time they're in this season. But there does seem to be a constant churn at the back of the top 25 this year. So,
yeah, there does.
We could talk about that. Or I thought we could touch on Fullerton. I mean, the Titans, I feel like we talked about them some early, but they are number 4 in our rankings, complete dismantling this weekend of a Pacific, much to Pacific alum Scott Boras' chagrin, I'm sure. You know, they lost midweek to Marymount, Fullerton did, but 24-4 and just un-Fullerton-like 45 runs this weekend in 3 games. This is just a kind of a they seem like a juggernaut to me, Aaron. I mean, they're rolling people in the Big West, and I don't see anybody in the Big West stopping them.
No, they're clearly the class of that conference. And you know, Cal Poly's solid this year. You know, Riverside's been feisty. Irvine had been good early and just got swept by Riverside. So I just, you know, I can't see any real challenger here for Fullerton. They're a very good ball club. The other series that you mentioned I wanted to touch on actually is that Oregon State San Diego series. I mean, I think Oregon State is going to miss Tyler Smith, you know, who's out for a little while here now with an injury. It's just your veteran shortstop. You replace him with Andy Peterson, who made some errors this weekend that cost him. You know, that's, to me, is something to watch here going forward. But without that guy, I mean, he's one of their best all-around players. And, you know, without him for the next several weeks, how will they hold up? You know, they went down there this weekend and played, I think, a very good offensive San Diego team. That's an offensive club. And they can score runs, and they did that this weekend against that Oregon State pitching staff, which all of a sudden doesn't look quite as invincible. But, you know, San Diego can have that effect on people. But, you know, San Diego's been up and down this year. It's been a weird season for those guys, too. So, first little hiccup for the Beavers. I still believe in the Beavers, obviously. But, you know, there's some chinks in the armor showing all of a sudden.
And it's the first time, like you said, they just have been so good this year. You know, it's really kind of hard to believe how well that team has played. Just on Fullerton real quick, Aaron, I mean, are you surprised? I'm a little surprised. It sounds like just talking to, again, an evaluator this weekend, it sounds like Michael Lorenzen has kind of adjusted his swing a little bit. I mean, this guy's having an All-America year. I mean, 5 home runs,
yes.
Hit one at Blair Field. He's got 15 extra base hits, and, oh, by the way, 8 saves. This guy really struggled mightily with Team USA last summer, and it seems like a light has come on a little bit for him offensively.
Yeah, it has. He's really made an adjustment, and he's not chasing that breaking ball down as much as he did before. That was really his bugaboo. Was he was very susceptible to a good slider or a power curveball, you know. And I think he's done a better job with that. He's worked hard in the off season, and you know, give him credit. And I think he's going to be a tough call for somebody in the draft. There are teams that like him as a pitcher because it, you know, it'll be 94-96. You know, that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
But I still have always kind of liked him as an outfielder. I think he's an athletic, you know, plus defender who can run, and if he hits, then you got something there. So
I mean, he sounds kind of like he's got a chance to be maybe a little bit less toolsy, but maybe better contact if this offensive improvement is to be believed. I mean, compare maybe a little bit with Drew Stubbs. I know he's not as electric, especially speed-wise, as Drew Stubbs, but he feels like there's some similarities there to Drew Stubbs.
Yeah, I could see that. That's the difference, though. You're right, is that he doesn't have that electric athleticism that Stubbs had. You're right. But you're right also that there's some similarities with the history of maybe contact issues and the overall athleticism. That's not bad. It's not a bad comp.
Throwing that to you out of left field there, but you know, Drew Stubbs hasn't had the big league career that I think a lot of us hoped he would have or thought he could have. His tools, I think, outside of the throwing arm, Drew Stubbs' tools greater than Michael Lorenzen's tools, which I think tells you a little bit about how tooled up Drew Stubbs was as an amateur. It feels like Michael Lorenzen, I have Kobe gone on the brain with the 50 walkless innings, which is hard for me to fathom. But Michael Lorenzen, as far as tools in college baseball, are there a lot of players outside of Hunter Renfroe who've got more tools than Michael Lorenzen? Probably not.
Probably not. Yeah, I mean,
he's up there with
Renfroe
for me for most toolsy college position player.
You can make a case for Aaron Judge and Austin Wilson, but you know, certainly those guys don't have the performance that matches any of these other guys we're talking about. But
yeah,
for raw tools, you could put those guys in that category as well.
I agree.
Chris Bryant. I mean, I think Chris Bryant, even though he doesn't have the speed tool those other guys have, he runs good enough, and those other tools are pretty loud.
There's so many scouts will tell you you're either a slug, you're average, or you're a burner, and everything else doesn't really matter that much. And certainly,
yeah,
I don't know if I'd say Lorenzen. He's not a burner, so he's probably more of an average. He's not a burner, is he? He's more of like a 60 runner, isn't he?
At best, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, he's closer to average than he is burner. So if you really talk about it that way, I could definitely see you putting Chris Bryant. If it were me right now lining up college position players for the draft, it's Chris Bryant first, and everybody else kind of has to fall in line after him.
Maybe so. Bryant, I think DJ Peterson, just because everybody loves the bat, and Renfroe is very intriguing, and it'll be interesting to see the way it shakes out. I don't feel like there's a lot of consensus on the position player side.
Yeah, I just think the thing is that the combination of Bryant's tools, track record, some athleticism, and the fact
yeah.
that he may not be as good of a pure hitter maybe as Peterson is, but in every other way, he's better. Colin Moran has a lot of those things going for him, but he just hasn't quite done it this year, not explosively with the power like Bryant and Peterson. And Bryant's just consistency, track record, his tools package overall compares well with Renfroe's. Renfroe's tools here, but Bryant's certainly more polished. I just think he has a little bit of what everybody else has, but he has more than everybody else. To me, he's the one college position player for me, I think he has the best combination of all those things. But we'll talk about that more as the year goes on, Fitzy.
Sounds good, John.
All right, Aaron's got to drive up here. We've got to do the Google Plus Hangout. Plenty more to come at baseballamerica.com today. So we'll wrap up the podcast early for Aaron. I'm John. We'll see you next week on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.